Good morning, brethren. I'm going to add one word to my title, just before Armageddon. Sister Kathy and I are very happy to see you all. We hope you're happy to see us too. We bring the love of the brethren in Allentown. Most of the class is here today. And we also bring love from a recent trip to the Portland Convention, and they wanted their love sent as well. Most Bible students watch the world very closely, and we do that as a matter of faith. We know that we're living here in the last days, and we know that we have certain expectations that prophecy has given us, so we watch. And I'm sure the things that you've watched here in the last week or so have you found very disturbing, perhaps profoundly disturbing. I'm speaking particularly of the Supreme Court decision to legalize gay marriage. I don't know how much you thought about it, but that makes the United States Sodom and Gomorrah, doesn't it? And it's not ending there. I saw on the internet last night a news item. There's a guy out in the West that's suing so that he can legally marry a second woman. Polygamy. I expect at some point that will be permitted. After all, isn't it your right? There's so many rights that people talk about. And Brother Russell talked about real and imagined rights. It's one of the qualities of our time. Of course, there's the fringe element. I saw about a year ago a woman who wanted to marry her dog. She sued to do that. I don't expect that to go through. But we look at these things, and we see the disintegration of our society. We see the economic system becoming more and more stressed. Again, watching the economies of our time, you see that those people that are in the know are very concerned. You know, it used to be in the past that if there was a monetary problem, the Federal Reserve could lower interest rates to stimulate. Well, guess what? They can't do that any further. Again, talk to Brother Lenny if you want the details of that. He's one of those financial watchers since that's his background. But this is the time we're living in. It is a time of trouble, and it's going to get worse. We'd like to look at a series of pictures in Scripture that describe the experiences of the last members of the church. We're talking about the feet members of the church, those that make it up to the point of Armageddon. And I'd like to begin by reading to you a question that was posed to Brother Russell in 1915. Now, you know, 1915 was a very interesting year for the Bible student movement, because on one hand, there was a disappointment of expectation on the part of many. But on the other hand, World War I had just started, which met expectations. But this is in the question book, page 617. This is from 1915. And Brother Russell's asked this question. Will all of the saints be taken beyond the veil before the time of trouble is over? And here is his answer. I am not wise enough to answer. I think no one is. We had thought so. We had supposed that all the saints would be beyond the veil before the times of the Gentiles ended. God did not say they would be, but we inferred so. And you know our inferences may prove wrong, and in this case did prove wrong. We were not taken. The times of the Gentiles have ended, and we are still here. So we do not know just when our time will come. To say that we will all be taken before the time of trouble is ended would be to say what I believe. There is one thing I think we all agree upon, that we believe that we will be taken before the Armageddon future. You know, the Bible gives us the symbols of the loosing of the winds, which are this great war. Then comes the earthquake, which is the great revolution to follow. Then comes the fire, the anarchy, Armageddon experiences. I think that the church, the bride class, will be gone before that Armageddon experience, but we cannot be sure. We will leave the subject there. So Brother Russell thought that the church would be complete before the Armageddon experiences. He did not nail it down. He left it open, but that was his expectation. So what we're going to do, as I mentioned this morning, we're going to look at a series of pictures that God has given us in Scripture. Each of them is a little snapshot of the very last experiences of the last members of the church. No picture gives the experience in its entirety, and many of the pictures overlap. They have some similar signs. But we want to take a look at this because we want to be forearmed. How does the saying go, to be forearmed, or is to be or forewarned is to be forearmed? I guess that's the right way of putting it. And we know that this is going to be a burden for those members of the church that live to the end. But it's not a bad thing for the new creature. Bad for the flesh, but the new creature will certainly shine in such experiences. So let's begin with the final experiences of Jesus. Now, we note that Jesus' experiences were not necessarily typical, but they certainly find a parallel in the final experiences of the church. And the big experience that Jesus had in the last day of his life was betrayal. Now, you know the story here. He was betrayed by Judas. And you know this was typified in the Old Testament. There was a close counselor to King David by the name of Ahithophel. And this was an older man, and he had been with David for a very long time. But he betrayed him. This can be found in 1 Samuel chapter 15. Now, we might say, well, why did he betray him? Well, the betrayal is explained by noting the fact that Ahithophel was Bathsheba's grandfather. So this might have been, in his mind, payback to David in some way. By the way, Brother Rick Sirossi has a beautiful lesson on bitterness where he deals with this at length. I highly recommend it. And also, incidentally, Ahithophel hanged himself just like Judas, so the type was quite complete. So that's the experience of Jesus. Let's translate it to our experiences. Brethren, some of the feet members of the church, the very final experiences of the church, will be betrayed. Now you might say, well, how can such a thing come about? We have so much love for one another, so much devotion to one another. How can one of us, and it will come from within ourselves, just as it came from within Jesus' disciples, how could that happen? Well, it happens because of a crisis that one would find himself. Let's consider what it would be like in those final experiences of the church. I expect, and we think we can have some scriptures that will show that as we go on, that the Bible student movement, and probably along with other movements, will be persecuted. Meetings may well be forbidden. The distribution of truth literature would be forbidden. Giving any kind of truth message would be made illegal. Now, by the way, we've already seen this in some places. In Canada, they enacted a law, and it comes under the category of hate crimes and hate laws, and we have some in this country as well, where it is illegal to say anything bad about homosexuals. And I remember listening to a radio show, I believe it was James Dobson's Focus on the Family, where they had to do a whole different set of shows for Canada because if they had said anything against homosexuality, they would be shut down. Now, brethren, that's the truth. The Bible forbids it. There's no question about it. So it's not hard to imagine that a time would come in this land where they'd say, if you say something about it, you're going to be accused of a hate crime, and we're going to shut you down or throw you into prison. That's just an example of one that's happened. But now suppose that pressure comes. It may be that a brother or a sister under such pressure might be asked to reveal the locations of other brethren, or information about how to communicate. In other words, asked to do an act of betrayal. It will come. And as I mentioned, it's scriptural that will come from within us. Psalm 41:9. Yea, mine own familiar friend in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread, hath lifted up his heel against me. Now that was David talking about Ahithophel, and it's also Jesus talking about Judas. But it will be our experiences as well. Brethren, what it should not do is make us suspicious of our brethren. We ought not to be looking at the side of our eyes and saying, okay, is he or she going to betray me? Brethren, that's in the Lord's hands. You know it's going to happen. Just don't be part of the source of it. Don't become a betrayer. And also remember that the betrayal worked God's will in the case of Jesus. It was God's will that he died. The betrayal had to come from somewhere. Brethren, it's no surprise. It's God's will for you to die as well. And for those of us that make it to the very end of this gospel age, the final end, that will be part of the experience. Secondly, a trial in the middle of the night. There are three texts of scriptures, and I just thought I'd better bring out my iPhone so I can watch my time here. By the way, everybody got it turned off? Silent. I thought it might be for a future talk, a good example of having the phone ring while I'm giving a talk. In Matthew chapter 25, verses 59 through 62, there is the description of the trial in the middle of the night. I'm going to read that one. That's the shortest of them. Now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witnesses against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Yea, though many false witnesses came, yet found they none. At last they found two false witnesses and said, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days.'" And the high priest arose and said to him, "Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witnesses witness against thee?" So there was the trial, false witnesses. You can also find a slightly expanded version in Mark chapter 14, verses 55 through 61. And in Luke 22:54, it adds a nice little detail that the others don't. Luke says, Then they took him and led him and brought him into the high priest's house. And Peter followed afar off. So not only was this trial illegal, it was in the middle of the night. And part of it was in a private home, not even in the area where such judicial cases should be kept. As it mentions here, there were many false witnesses that came forth, but some of them had such ridiculous tales to tell that their testimony was rejected even by the clergy. But when they found two, do you notice the testimony that they gave? They gave a true testimony. "This man said," and they quoted him more or less accurately. So they used something that Jesus said, twisted it, perverted it, and then used it against him. Our experience. Brethren, there'll come a time when our trials may not be in the open either. We can expect false witnesses to preach against us. As they did with those two, they may take some level of truth and then twist it to suit what they want. And remember, just as Jesus' enemies were, so ours are always looking for something against us. Now let's think about this for a minute. This is the United States. How can such a thing happen in the United States? Well, brethren, have you ever heard of the Patriot Act, which was just changed, I think, into the Freedom Act? Have you ever read the Patriot Act? If you read it, I think you'd be surprised. There are things in there dealing with national security that allow individuals to be arrested and confined without due process of law. It's already on the books. Now, again, I haven't read this new one, that I guess called the Freedom Act, you know, I haven't read that one. But this is not such outlandish ideas. When the government wants to do something, they will find a way to do something, just as they did with Jesus. Our next is the rationalization of murder. John 11, verses 49 through 50. And one of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest of that same year, said unto them, "Ye know nothing at all, nor consider it that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, that the whole nation perisheth not." Do you notice the rationale here? We got to take care of our nation. Yeah, this guy's gonna die, but that's okay in comparison with taking care of our nation. Brother, we just mentioned the Patriot Act. The guise is that even murder will be used if it's expedient to preserve public peace and public security. It becomes a national security issue. And we've already mentioned about the hate crime laws that are on the books here in this country and in Canada. Wouldn't take much for that to be expanded to anyone, I repeat, anyone that disturbs the public peace through a message that the public doesn't like. Brethren, our experience is, or our experience will be at that time, that the common good will be used as a rationalization for persecution against us, even to the murdering and persecution of the church. Our next picture is Jesus on the cross. This is found in Luke chapter 23, verses 39 through 43. And one of the malefactors which were hanged railed on him, saying, "If thou be the Christ, save thyself and us." But the other, answering, rebuked him, saying, "Dost not thou fear God, seeing thou art in the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive due reward for our deeds, but this man hath done nothing amiss." And he said unto Jesus, "Lord, remember me when thou comest to thy kingdom." And Jesus said to him, "Verily I say unto thee, today thou shalt be with me in paradise." So this is the traditional picture of Jesus flanked on either side by two malefactors. You notice one didn't believe and even mocked him, and the other did believe and asked to be remembered. Brethren, when the persecution time comes for the last members of the church, when we who live to that time go through our crucifixion experiences, it's good to note that there will be others among us that are not of the little flock. In the case of Jesus, you had one group that didn't believe. What group might that be? Well, could be libertarians, rational anarchists, survivalists, people that object to what the government is doing. And of course the government will be persecuting us, but it'll be persecuting them too, using the same rationale. They're not believers, but they may well be in the same line of sights along with the little flock. And on the other hand, there was a group of believers. Who might this be? Well, it could be members of the nominal churches. It could even be tares who recognize that they're no longer true Christians, but still object to what's going on. So I think that when this final time comes, you can look that there will be others in the, as we mentioned, in the line of sights with the governments along with the little flock. And this shouldn't be a surprise to us. It seems to be pictured here. Our next example is the prophecy of Micaiah, 1 Kings chapter 22. Don't know if you've read this. This is actually quite an entertaining piece of biblical narrative. Let me give you the background. At this point in time, war had been going on with Syria, between Israel and Syria, for some 3 years. So King Ahab sends a message to King Jehoshaphat. He says, "You know, Ramoth-Gilead," he says, "the Syrians got it. That should belong to us. So why don't we get together and we'll make war against the king of Syria and we'll get back what belongs to us." Well, King Jehoshaphat comes and he says, "All right, well, I'll participate." He says, "But, you know, shouldn't we get the God's prophets to tell us if this is a good idea or not?" And King Ahab there says, "Okay, no problem." So he brings in 400 of his prophets. By the way, this is probably the same group of, you know, remember the 450 on Mount Carmel? I think we're talking about the same group here. And, of course, what's the message that the prophets of Baal give? You can guess. "Yeah, go to war. You're going to win. It's going to be wonderful. You're going to accomplish your goals just plain." Well, King Jehoshaphat, he still has some reservations. He said, "Well, don't you have a prophet of Jehovah here?" He wants a prophet of Jehovah. Remember, he's a Judah, so they're slightly more loyal than those kings of Israel. Well, let's pick up the narrative in verse 8, 1 Kings 22:8. We're going to read along here, and I'm going to stop and make comments as we read. "And the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, 'There is yet one man, Micaiah, the son of Imaiah, by whom we may inquire of the Lord. But I hate him.'" Well, why does he hate him? "It says, 'For he doth not prophesy good concerning me, but evil.'" Well, you can see Ahab saying, "Yeah, we got one here, but yeah, every time I talk to this guy, he's only got bad things to say about me." And Jehoshaphat said, "Let the king not say so." And the king of Israel called an officer and said, "Hasten hither Micaiah the son of Amaiah." So they bring him on board. And the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, sat on the throne, having put on their robes in a void place in the entrance of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets prophesied before them. So you have to picture this now. Here's the two kings in their royal robes, looking splendid, in their regal splendor. And here's 400 prophets of Micaiah, and there's probably an unnamed number of the public there. And Zedekiah, the son of Chenaiah, this is the chief of the prophets of Baal, made him horns of iron. Now imagine this, he's got a headdress here with horns of iron, right? He comes in looking silly, right? And he said, "Thus saith the Lord, with these shalt thou push the Syrians until thou hast consumed him." And all the prophets prophesied so, saying, "Go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it into the king's hand. So that was the united and unanimous testimony. And the messenger that was gone to call Micaiah spake to him. All right, so here we are now at Micaiah's house. Here's the messenger for the king, saying, behold, now the words of the prophets declare good unto the king with one mouth. Let thy word, I pray thee, be like the word as one of them, and speak that which is good. In other words, the messenger saying, look here, make sure you give a good message in front of the king. Everybody else has. They're unanimous. When you come, you better say something good. Remember, Ahab's already worried. This guy never says anything good about me. So he's getting warned up front here. Verse 14. And Micaiah said, as the Lord liveth, what the Lord saith unto me, that will I speak. So he came unto the king, and the king said unto him, Micaiah, shall we go against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall we forbear? By the way, this is pretty neat here. You notice he doesn't say, hi, Micaiah, how are you? Right? He's in front. All right, here's the question. Go or not go? Yeah, Ahab doesn't want too much more to talk with him. And Micaiah says, go and prosper, for the Lord will deliver it into the hand of the king. So Micaiah says, yeah, go ahead and go. In other words, he's saying what the messenger told him to say. But he must have said it very sarcastically. Because you notice what Ahab says next. And the king says to him, how many times shall I adjure thee that ye tell me nothing but that which is true in the name of the Lord? Ahab knew this was, he was mocking him, right? I mean, you can see it. Yeah, yeah, go. Yeah, whatever, you know, it'll be fine. Give me the right one. Verse 17. Here's what Micaiah says. Here's his prophecy. And he said, I saw all Israel scattered upon the hills as sheep that have not a shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no master. Let them return every man to his house in peace. So Ahab knows what this means. His armies are scattered. Everybody goes home. It's not a good thing. In verse 18, the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, did I not tell thee he would prophesy no good concerning me but evil? Didn't I tell you he would say this? You can sort of see this picture unfolding. And Micaiah goes a little bit further, verse 19. And he said, hear thou therefore the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing by him, on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, who shall persuade Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said on this matter, and one said on another matter. By the way, in this whole prophecy here, this is the only time where the name Ahab is used for the king of Israel. Through the whole account, it says the king of Israel, the king of Israel, the king of Israel. Never says Ahab, except here. You know who it is. But I can't wonder if that's significant from a prophetic standpoint. Let's read further, verse 21. And there came forth a spirit, and stood before the Lord, and said, I will persuade him. And the Lord said unto him, wherewith? And he said, I will go forth, and I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of the prophets. And he said, thou shalt persuade him, and prevail. Go forth, and do so. Now therefore, behold, the Lord hath put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these 400 prophets. And the Lord hath spoken evil concerning thee. It was very clear what he was saying. You know, the message that these guys gave you, guess what? It's a lie. And you're going to fall. But Zedekiah, here's the chief of the Baal prophets now, the son of Chenaiah, went near and smote Micaiah on the cheek and said, which way went the spirit of the Lord from me to speak unto thee? Gave him a slap on the cheek. And Micaiah said, behold, thou shalt see in that day when thou shalt go to an inner room chamber to hide thyself. And now the consequences to Micaiah. Verse 26. And the king of Israel said, take Micaiah, carry him back unto Ammon, the governor of the city, and to Joash, the king's son. And thus saith the king, put this fellow in prison, and feed him with the bread of affliction and the water of affliction until I come in peace, until I come back in peace. He said, we'll see, we're going to put this guy in prison, and then I'll come back and deal with him further later. And Micaiah said, if thou return in peace, the Lord hath not spoken by me. And he said, hearken, O people, every one of you. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat and the king of Judah went up to Ramoth-Gilead. Well, we won't go any further. Guess what happened? It did not go well. In fact, when they're going up, Ahab has this plan. He says, I'm just going to dress sort of very much of like a camouflage. And Jehoshaphat, you wear the robes, though. And Jehoshaphat, it sounds like he was a little gullible, but he's, okay, this sounds like a good idea. So they go there. And the Syrians see the king. Guess where they go? They head to Jehoshaphat, right? And it scares the dickens out of him. But they get close enough to see, hey, wait a second, this is not Ahab. So now they come back looking. Ahab, meanwhile, not dressed in the robes of the king at all, one arrow shot from some man pierces him, and it's a mortal wound. He's on his chariot. He's bleeding profusely. He says, I'm wounded. Get me out of here. Well, he dies on that chariot. And the account goes on to say when the chariot was brought back into Samaria, they were cleaning the chariot off with water. The blood was going on, and the dogs were licking up the blood. That was part of the prophecy that he would die, that he would fall, and the dogs would lick his blood. By the way, you remember his wife's name? Jezebel. What happened to her? She had an encounter with the dogs too, didn't she? We won't go into that because that's a whole other picture. So let's summarize. The king gathers advisors to tell him what he wants to hear. There's a union of heart of the civil and religious forces. The true prophecy has an opportunity, except for a little sarcasm. He tells him to go would be a disaster. Micaiah gets thrown into prison for the message with bread and water. This, brethren, is another depiction of our experiences. The rulers at the very end of the gospel age will seek advice from their religious partners in an ecumenical spirit and hear what they want to hear to maintain power. But those of the little flock of the true church will speak out in loyalty to God. The result? Imprisonment. Incidentally, did you notice that one of the false prophets named Zedekiah made this headdress horns of iron? Does it make you think of the two-horned beast in Revelation chapter 13:11? I think there's a connection, and I think it's worthwhile for further study. Let's go on to our next picture. Three fellows that you know well. Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego. This is in Daniel chapter 3. It's a long story, so I'm just going to sort of bullet point some of the things here. Nebuchadnezzar set up an image of gold on the plain of Dura in Babylon. The height was 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. 6-6. Seem interesting? I think it is. You go back to Revelation, you got 666. So this 6-6 is something a little shorter than that. He arranged a huge dedication ceremony, gathered together the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the kingdom. And they proclaimed that when you hear the sound of the music, bow down and do worship to this image. And by the way, if you don't, you're going into the fiery furnace. So this is what you call an incentive. Certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. There was a certain Jew who the king had set over affairs by the name of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they said, these men, O king, have not regarded thee. They're not serving your gods. And they're not worshiping the image that you set up. Well, the king's pretty upset about this. In a rage, he commands them to be brought forth. And by the way, my guess is that these were governors over different places. So they weren't all in one place not doing the worship. They were with whatever their particular representatives from their governorship were. But they took note of it. Notice it says that Chaldeans noticed this. This sounds a little bit organized, doesn't it? They wanted to get back. We saw the same thing with Daniel, didn't we, with the lion's den? You know, they wanted to get him, and so they set up a plan. So same too here. So Nebuchadnezzar has them before them. And they say, O king, we're not careful in this matter, but we want to let you know that we obey God and we worship only him, and we're not going to worship your God. We're not going to bow down. Nebuchadnezzar gives them a chance to recant, but they don't take it. And he's so upset over their response, he says, all right, make that fiery furnace 7 times as hot, and we're going to throw them in there. Well, that's what they do. And you may remember that they choose some noble men from the kingdom to throw them in, and the fire was so hot that it consumed the men that were throwing the three in. By the way, we've tried to imagine what this furnace looked like, because it says they fell down and they were all bound and whatnot. Evidently, it was a furnace. There was an opening at the top they could throw it in, but there was an opening in the side where you could look in as well. Well, it was through that opening in the side that Nebuchadnezzar looked in and he saw people walking around in there. Not just three, but there was a fourth member as well. Somehow their God had preserved them through this. And by the way, when they went down there, what the fire did break is their bonds. Broke all their bonds away. I will read a few verses here. Verse 28. This is Nebuchadnezzar's reaction to seeing their deliverance. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that every nation, people, language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. What do we derive from this? What are our experiences that we can expect from this? Nebuchadnezzar here represents both the civil and religious powers, since he was in charge of the gods as well as the civil authorities. And what he did is, or was attempting to do, is to unify the religious elements in his empire. Now, this was a pagan religion, and there was a god of Babylon, there was a god of Assyria, there was a gods of Egypt. Probably had a lot of different people, since this was a world empire that had conquered many peoples. So there might have been different religious thoughts, very likely that there was. So by setting up this image, he's attempting to unify all the religious thinking into one kingdom-ordained mode of worship. We think that this represents the Protestant Federation, the spirit of ecumenism that we see growing and beginning to cooperate with papacy. Here's a short quote from Volume 4, page 581. "In harmony with this, we find in Revelation 13, 14 through 18, a prophecy of special combination of influence by which Protestant denominations will be unified, and those separate will be brought into cooperation with the papacy, in a manner that will give both increased powers, deceiving many into supposing that the new combination will be by God's instrumentality for doing the work predicted of Messiah, and thus his representative." And one more quote from reprint 2495, again the same idea. "As already pointed out, the beast represents not Roman Catholics, the people, but the Roman Catholic system as an institution. And the image represents not Protestants, the people, but the consolidation of Protestant systems as an institution." And you know it's in the image of the beast, because 666 is just a little bit less than 666. There's definitely that connection there. Brethren, just a few years ago, I got an email from Brother Bill Gill. He says, "You got to see this video." Just a couple of years ago. I think many of you got the video. You know what I'm going to talk about. There was a very successful and well-known televangelist by the name of Kenneth Copeland. He's still on the airwaves today. And in many ways, he represents the evangelism, the televangelism that is so popular in this country, and I guess in other places as well, but certainly in the United States. And he had a guest speaker there who was affiliated with the Catholic Church. That raised an eyebrow, first of all. But you're watching this video, and this speaker is going on and on about the importance of unification and the importance of ecumenism. And then he says, by the way, he says, "I got a special message for you in a video, and I'd like to play it." And he plays this video, and it's Pope Francis reaching out to this. And by the way, this particular service was not a public service. This was a convention of evangelicals that were there at Kenneth Copeland. This is the clergy of the charismatic movement there. And the Pope gives this speech about the importance of recognizing roots and cooperation and the need to stick together, and you've heard it all before. Wow, I saw this. It knocked me over. I mean, I've been watching the church get together with the Church of England, and there's been this, that, and the other thing. But who would have thought that the charismatic movement, the televangelists, would start to get locked in with the Pope? It was just unbelievable. Well, brethren, this fits into the picture that we're looking at very, very much. The true church will not obey and worship as these systems want to do. What are the results? Will be those around us who see that we're not, just as with Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, and report us. We'll be brought in for questioning, just like they were, given an opportunity to recant. And by the way, this was the modus operandi back in the terms of Rome, you know, that if you didn't do a pinch of incense to the emperor, you know, they'd round you up and say, all right, here's some incense, here's your chance. Be similar to us. But we won't change our position, those that are of the little flock and loyal. We'll be bound and imprisoned, and we will be executed. By the way, you notice in this picture here that we're considering that the execution was being thrown into the fire, but they survived that. Well, our execution, we will survive that too by being resurrected to the divine nature. Be promoted. And you notice that Jehoshaphat did that, and they promoted these to a higher opportunity. We'll do one more and then conclude. Again, very quickly, in Daniel chapter 5, you have the picture of Daniel before Belshazzar. And you remember, this is the night that Babylon fell. They had a drunken orgy, big feast, big festival going on, big party. And they brought in the holy utilities or utensils of the Lord. And then you remember the disembodied hand wrote, "Meeni, meeni, tekel, upharsin." Nobody could figure out what that meant, so the queen says, hey, bring Daniel in. Daniel must have been close to 100 years old by this time. The king offers gifts to Daniel to interpret the writing, but he says, keep your gifts, I'll tell you what it means. He gives him the message, he interprets it, and he gets the gifts anyway. Our experience. There will be a great feast, that is, a great celebration, before the destruction of Babylon, well, which seems to correspond well with the great denominational union we expect. The abused temple vessels, Brother Russell suggests in reprint 2487, the golden vessels represent the little flock, silver vessels, great company. There will be an abuse of those who are spirit begotten. Daniel here, we think, represents the little flock. And after he gives that, he's put on a scarlet robe. In this picture, I think that represents his death and his victory in death. And then afterward, he's given a golden chain. We think of the golden of the divine nature. Brethren, we've looked at a few pictures here that describe the experiences. There are more than this. And again, we don't give them to you to discourage you, but rather to help you to recognize that if you are permitted to live till the very end of this system, to be part of that class which is martyred, it's a great privilege. And God foresaw what your loyalty would show and what your loyalty would bring. Let me conclude reading a little bit here from the second volume, page 264. Brother Russell says, first, we should be so prepared, so armed, so thoroughly furnished with the invincible truth that persecution would move us only to greater zeal and not lead us through surprise or fear to lower our standard, nor to surrender when the kings of the earth are gathered against us and against the truths to which God has granted us the privilege of witnessing as his servants and ambassadors. Second, such reflections relative to the future, contrasted with the privileges of the present, should serve to stimulate every consecrated child of God to make diligent use of the present grand harvest opportunities and privileges, remembering that he that reapeth receiveth wages, as truly as he was planted and watered, and that now preeminently is a time for gathering fruit unto eternal life. The little quiet of the present favorable time, with its greater liberties and advantages in every way, is divinely arranged in order for the sealing of the true servants of God in their foreheads, intellectually with the truth. Brethren, we don't quite have the peace that Brother Russell described there at the end of the 19th century when the second volume was written, but we still have opportunities. There is still time for us to do harvest work. There is still time to put on the character of Jesus. There is still time to witness to the world. Let us make use of that time. And I will conclude with the theme text of this convention, which fits beautifully, Luke 21:28. But when all this is beginning to take place, grieve no longer. Lift up your heads, because your deliverance is draweth nigh. May the Lord bless this to you.